It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.
Our guest on Farm to Table Talk today is Glenda Humiston, and Glenda is the Vice President of the University of California's Agriculture and Natural Resources Group. And Glenda, it's great to have you back on Farm to Table Talk.
Great to be here with you.
Glenda, I want to talk about something today that people may have a hard time understanding where it fits between the farm and the table, and that is biomass. But I think we need to start off with an explanation of really what is biomass. It's not something that the average person works into an everyday conversation. So what is biomass?
It's a lot of different things. The easiest thing people probably think of is just wood itself. Wood is a biomass. Actually, all food is a biomass. It's biologic material, carbon. The stuff you throw into your compost maker, that's all biomass. Lawn trimmings that people run into every day, all of that is biomass.
So it's like everything you can't consume. Then it's not.
It's everything you can't consume, but it includes everything you can as well. Everything you eat is biomass.
Ah, but you convert it.
And, you convert it.
But if it's not converted, then all of that, so all the fruits and all the vegetables and everything the animals eat, it's all biomass.
Exactly. As is the grass clippings that you mow off of your lawn and the trees in the forest.
So if you don't eat it or turn it into a house that you have boards and so forth and materials like that, it can become organic matter too, right? That gets back into the soil and builds the soil up as well?
It can. Some uses for biomass is composting, mulching, that kind of thing. But the problem we've got here in California is we've got a lot more biomass than we could possibly ever use as compost or mulch. Plus, it's just not cost-effective to try to deal with our large sources of biomass to transport it to where it could be utilized as compost or mulch.
So if it's in the fields, you've got stalks and vines and so forth, that the fruits and vegetables have been harvested, it may be shredded, some products are straw or something like that, mm-hmm. that they're able to harvest off of it. Others might be, again, shredded or disc or just let to kind of rot into the soil and build up the soil again. And others have to be hauled off or disposed with. Is that right?
Yeah, and all too often what we've done in the past is we've burnt it, and increasingly we're recognizing that that is just not a good option as a way to handle this biomass. We don't want that smoke, particularly those particulates in our air. It's a major cause of air quality problems, particularly down in the San Joaquin Valley.
Well, what are some of the areas that are on your mind right now that look like solutions to deal with the biomass issues and to make better utilization of the biomass?
Well, you know, there's been a lot of people looking at this for quite a while. 20, 30 years ago, one of the solutions people were very excited about was to combust the biomass and convert it into electricity. And we still have quite a few of those biomass plants around the state, but increasingly they're closing down because they just aren't cost effective. They can't compete with natural gas, and frankly, they can't even really compete with solar and wind anymore. So you can't really use it for electricity that way. Some folks are looking at new technologies like pyrolysis and torrefaction that can convert it into a liquid fuel, and that does have some promise. Because when you use that type of biogas fuel after you've processed it, it actually can help improve air quality versus traditional petroleum products. But again, there's just a lack of processing facilities, and you've still got the huge issue of transporting at any distance. Biomass, by its very nature, is bulky and heavy and very expensive to transport. So you really want to get its early stage processing in as small a distance as possible.
So if you can have it in a forest, or if you can have it near the farms or wherever it's being produced, you want to have something processing it close by.
Yeah, and that's been one of the real challenges we've had. And that's why right now I'm working very closely with the leadership of the Regional Council of Rural Counties, commonly known as RCRC, which is more than half of the counties in the state. About two-thirds of the counties are active members, your more rural ones. And we're trying to really take a very innovative approach to this and see if we can't create an entire supply chain virtually at once as part of a larger business plan, is one way to describe it. So we're looking at the possibility of creating early stage bioprocessing facilities up the entire length of the Sierra and even over in the Cascades that would do that early stage processing. Because the first two or three steps for virtually any high value use of biomass is pretty similar. And that term high value is really important, because composting and mulch and even things like biochar, they're just not profitable. They cost way too much money to do, and we just can't try to constantly subsidize these activities with government dollars. So we're looking for real high-value uses of this biomass, which actually have some other great side benefits. Things like cellulosic nanofibers, which are just a breakdown of biomass into tiny little nanofibers. 1,000 of them would be smaller than a human hair. And when you add these nanofibers to plastics or cement or a variety of other building materials, it makes that material both stronger and lighter. So you could see how that'd be real useful in like cement products or car body parts. Ford Motor Company's looking at that for car body parts. We're also looking at things like bioplastics. A lot of stuff in our life these days are made of plastic, and virtually all that plastic that's currently made from petroleum as a base, and that's most of it, could be made from biomass. So you'd be actually sequestering carbon there, as well as creating a new high-value use for that biomass. And then, of course, there's some new, very high-tech timber products that are being used in some really exciting building. Portland, Oregon just broke ground on an 18-story tall building that will be made from wood. British Columbia, Europe, many other parts of the world have been for the last several years moving towards a wood-first policy in their building. And what's exciting about these buildings is they actually lower carbon footprint, they are better in an earthquake, and they're more energy efficient. So it's really a win-win-win in many ways. And if we can create the market for those, which is another thing we're working on, we'll have some great economic development opportunity in our rural areas, our forest communities, that just hasn't been there for a couple decades.
Yeah, I can't think of a skyscraper made of wood. That's just incredible.
I mean, they do exist.
They do. I mean, I've never heard of them, though, before, until you're telling me right now.
I didn't know about them until the last 2 years myself. But they do exist. Europe's been doing this for quite a while, and Canada has as well. In fact, Canada has a wood-first policy that's slowly making its way into the U.S., which is one of the reasons why Portland, Oregon just jumped onto it.
Well, the other thing that you're making this out of really kind of byproduct. I mean, if you're dealing with biomass, you're not dealing with the boards you normally think you build a house out of.
Exactly. No, this is biomass that typically would be considered waste. In the bad old days, couple decades ago, it might have even been stuff that was filling up our landfills. Nowadays, our landfills are trying to divert this because it's ridiculous to be putting this into landfills. It's also bad, as I said earlier, to be burning it. But we've got a lot of biomass, and it's not just the 120 million dead trees that many of us are worried about up in our forest. It's agriculture, and it's urban, it's municipal. All those lawn trimmings and pruned trees in an urban area have to go somewhere, as does orchards and vineyards when they get pulled out and replaced. You know, walnut shells, the leftover biomass from food processing. You know, when you're shaving those carrots or you're taking the core out of an apple, that's all got to go somewhere. So the problem the thing we haven't had in the past is a high value use for those, which could actually get people interested in creating a market for them.
Well, how would you describe the status quo right now as far as a carbon footprint? I mean, our current system and what effect not recovering this biomass or the current uses is maybe having towards climate change?
Well, I don't know the exact numbers, but I do know it is one of the things people are very concerned about, because when you have piles of, let's say, the byproducts of any kind of food that's rotting somewhere, manure from livestock, trees that are composting, you're putting off a lot of carbon dioxide as well as a lot of methane in some cases, all of which are greenhouse gases.
Wow.
Now, some of that you need.
Sure.
Some of that is part of the natural processes in nature. Mm-hmm. Some of it you need. But some of it where mankind is affecting the natural processes, for example, all these dead trees we've got currently, and big, huge, removal of an orchard or a vineyard, you know, a lot of biomass all of a sudden that wouldn't have necessarily been there. That's when you got to start finding some other uses so that you can help keep the overall ecological balance.
Help me paint a picture of what that might look like. Say in a local area, might there be, is there a physical facility that's built that grinds it up and does something to it to convert this biomass? Could you describe that roughly, what that might look like?
Well, actually, there's some in existence right now that I mentioned earlier, the cogeneration plants.
Mm-hmm.
They get this biomass, they grind it up, they feed it into generators that burn it, and that heat then turns turbines that create electricity. We've had those for two or three decades here in California, and we still have some.
Mm-hmm.
They work fine. The technology's fine. It works. It's just that the cost of getting the biomass there, the processing, the burning, the creation of the electricity, when that electricity comes out the other end, is much more expensive than electricity you can get from solar or wind or natural gas.
Mm-hmm.
You can't really expect us to keep doing biomass there without huge public subsidies. And that's something that just isn't sustainable in the long run.
What about the materials that would be made out of wood, out of timber, that you were mentioning, that someday we'll be building our skyscrapers out of?
New technology.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that's come out of forest products laboratories at universities. There's actually a large foundation, the Bi-National Softwood Lumber Foundation, I believe. That's the U.S. and Canada working closely together on this. The Forest Service has been part of this, their research arm, too. This is, and I don't, you know, Roger, I'm not a techie on this.
Mm-hmm.
I don't profess to understand how they make this work, but Well, we've all seen pressed wood and plywood and that kind of product. We've had that for decades.
Mm-hmm.
This would be kind of like a 2017 Mercedes-Benz top-of-the-line car versus an Edsel from the 1950s. Mm-hmm. It would be that kind of comparison. Much, much tighter connection between the biomass itself into much stronger resilient wood products, which is why they can use them in tall buildings.
So you're deconstructing it into tinier and tinier particles that are reconstructed or put back together again and formed into all of these other
exactly.
products then.
Exactly.
Now if you come,
you know, any woodworker will tell you when they glue two pieces of board together and that breaks later on, it wasn't the glue that broke.
Yeah.
It was the board.
What about opportunities, say, get down away from the forest in areas around agricultural areas, or like you said, even lawn clippings and trees, but also crop residues and almond hulls and that sort of thing? How might that progress in, you know, the middle of a state someplace that's not up into the forest areas?
Well, what we're looking to do, the proposal we've been working on is to create, like I said, these early stage bioprocessing along the Sierra, just because there is a lot of volume there. Mm-hmm. You'd also have some of those down in the valley floor. But what we're envisioning is that those would then, several small ones, would feed into a manufacturing facility that would be on some of the existing industrial sites we have in Fresno and the Port of Stockton, Castle Air Force Base in Merced. There's locations up and down the valley where we've got industrial-type land already zoned and in some cases shuttered old manufacturing facilities that could be revived that are along highways and railroads. That's what we need. The other thing we need, though, and again, this is the forest biomass, the urban, the ag, for all of it. Let's say we have those manufacturing capability. We need the market. And that's where University of California is trying to really play a large role. One of President Napolitano's initiatives is for the University of California to be carbon neutral by 2025. And that's not very far away. One of the ways we could help get there is if we, the University of California, were able to adopt a wood-first policy. We right now have a lot of new students coming on. In fact, it's estimated that over the next several years, we need to be building about 20,000 beds, so to speak, you know, housing units, as well as classrooms and laboratories and everything else. This is something you see, the CSU, the community college, all of us are actually expanding, as are other large institutions. We've actually had indications from some private sector entities that they would like to start looking at this wood first policy. So then basically, if you think about it, you've got your early stage feedstock, you've got the early processing, you've got a manufacturing facility, and you've got the market. So you've completed the entire supply chain, which makes this whole project a lot more feasible. I myself am proposing that we utilize a lot of our own funding here in California to do it, try to keep this locally owned, partially just because a lot of my own research previously has shown that makes for a much better economic development overall in the long run. So we're looking at the possibility of those early stage bioprocessing facilities actually being locally owned, but organized in something like a cooperative situation. In fact, the model is Ace Hardware. Have you ever wondered how Ace Hardware is able to survive and quite frankly, thrive with Home Depots and other big box stores like that out there?
Well, no, and they've got three people smiling at you as soon as you walk in and taking you to wherever you need to buy 20 cents worth of bolts.
Exactly. In no way, shape, or form should a single Ace Hardware be able to survive on its own. It couldn't compete.
Right.
But what they've done that is quite brilliant, as far as I'm concerned, Ace Hardware is a cooperative. Each of those individual stores is individually owned and operated, but those owners have joined a cooperative that gets them economies of scale. They can get their health care, their liability insurance. They can do bulk purchasing. They can manage their transportation and distribution networks so that they basically have the same advantages of a big box like Home Depot.
And now you're talking about systems like a cooperative. Is this something that you could envision Ag Economics Department or some of the other issues groups putting together potential budgets and structures and ideas on how to form a cooperative to work on this kind of program?
They've been doing that for years. That's the reason I know about it. Much of what I'm sharing with you right now, I've read in research papers, and I've seen studies and analysis. This has been thoroughly worked out and actually implemented in many, many ways. In fact, an awful lot of your farm-to-fork activity has looked at exactly these kind of business models and these cooperatives. There's a lot of cooperatives in the food system.
Are you able to, you know, dedicate somebody at the on staff at some point to work on this that can specialize in seeing the implementation of these programs as far as biomass is?
Well, you know, actually, we haven't got to the point of that yet, but we do have a lot of people already in the system working on different aspects of this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so for example, we've got cooperative extension specialists that do research on forest economics and forest products. UC Berkeley has a forest products laboratory there at the campus and forest research science center. I was just down at UC Merced a couple days ago. Their School of Engineering has a materials science department that's already working on exactly these kind of new, very innovative uses of biomass. In fact, it's pretty amazing some of the stuff they're working on. It's right up there at the cutting edge. We've got folks from the MBA programs who've done business plans and analysis around these kind of things. I mean, so we've got different parts of the UC already working on it. I think what we're trying to do right now is just make sure we harness the power of all those different aspects of UC to help find and implement the solution that I'm describing to you today, building a biomass ecosystem here in California that would not only help us deal with some environmental issues, but would produce some really powerful economic development opportunities.
Well, that sounds really exciting. And then you added back to Janet Napolitano's goal with carbon neutral.
Well, she said that the University of California will be carbon neutral.
Sure.
And see, that gets back to the idea of the anchor institution. The University of California is a giant institution. It's so big that it does give us some leeway to do some experimental things that a smaller entity might not be able to afford. Either not afford directly or just not afford to be able to take the risk. So by the University of California doing stuff like finding new ways of getting energy efficiencies and managing water and cutting down on carbon footprints, we then can share those with the rest of the world so that it can be replicated.
Now, that's exciting. And, you know, one other thought I had is that I've been hearing that the people that are looking into more and more hydroponic type of production systems are also looking at the substrate that in a way is the material that takes the place of soil that it's used to hold the seed and where everything is coming into it. But they're looking at materials like nut hulls. So they can take walnut hulls and almond hulls and grind them up. And they're almost, again, create a medium to produce food in. As an alternative when the soil isn't available, that rooftops or wherever.
Well, yeah, and actually, that's one whole aspect of a different use of biomass that's pretty exciting. But you're bringing up something else, which is controlled environment agriculture, which is probably another podcast, Roger, because we're doing some real exciting work in that too.
Let's do a tease on that one right now, Glenda. Go ahead and
okay, well, one of the entities that has approached us several months ago to look at this is folks in Southern California that are very active with two things. One is finding a use for old abandoned manufacturing sites and warehouses in urban areas, which could be converted to food production. But the other one that's kind of really fun is Southern California still has a really strong aerospace industry hub. They're looking to try to specialize and carve out for themselves a leadership role in food for the moon and Mars. How are we going to feed people if we're going to send people to the moon and Mars? Building an institute, a world institute on controlled environment agriculture.
Really? And if that happened, would that take place, do you think, within the next 5 years?
Absolutely. We got people wanting to move on it pretty fast.
I have, Glenda, I've talked to some people that are taking abandoned buildings back in the Midwest, actually a supermarket chain, mm-hmm. that is taking some empty supermarkets and turning them into farms.
Absolutely. Los Angeles, the city of Los Angeles, is already pretty aggressively pursuing a whole business plan around that for the city.
Well, that really is exciting, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it'd be nice. There's going to have to do a certain amount of reconstruction. Maybe they can use some of those new materials from new biomass
Process. Exactly. New biomass products. That'd be great.
This is going to be like a new expo center of some sort here that everybody's going to want to see. It's an exciting vision.
Well, plus think about all the packaging that's on our food now.
Yeah.
Wouldn't it be nice if all of that was made from if we used bioplastics for all our packaging? It'd all be biodegradable.
Yeah, no, it would be. It'd be wonderful. And you're opening up an area here that's going to take a lot of explanation. And it takes a university and with vision like you guys, like the University of California has, to get these things started. But it'll take some investors to come in, too. Glenda, one more thing. I wanted to go 180 degrees from where we're talking right now, because I want to go back to when you were getting started. Because when you and I had a conversation a few months back, and I went back and I listened to that conversation before, and I remember you're talking about getting started in the Peace Corps.
Yeah.
And you know, when I'm sitting here listening to you, and you're talking about all these things that are very futuristic, and then I remember you're saying about, I think, growing up in Colorado,
mm-hmm.
and going to Colorado State, and kind of the inspiration you got of, you know, going into the Peace Corps. And somewhere you must have had this, got more and more certain that you wanted to be involved in food and agriculture and in on the track you're in. And I wonder if you ever stopped to think about that, how far you are from Africa now and Peace Corps work, talking about all of these things that we may do to help people when they get to Mars.
Yeah, but in some ways it's a circle, because I often tell folks when I'm doing public speaking that I wouldn't be where I am today without 4-H. I was very active in 4-H as a young person, and that's what exposed me to college at all. I'm the first one in my family to go to college.
Mm-hmm.
So 4-H got me started. College kept me going in some interesting directions, and now I oversee the programs here in California that include 4-H. And actually, one of the fastest growing projects in 4-H here in California is things like robotics and drones and STEM. We're trying to get these kids really excited in science and innovation and inventing. So it really is a circle.
Wow. Yeah, I think I got started in 4-H as well. And, and I just see all of these applications are exciting. What about the Peace Corps years? Were you involved in food production projects when you were in the Peace Corps?
Yeah, actually, it was a large food production project. I was the agricultural management specialist advising on an $11 million, 1,000-cow dairy project in North Africa.
Good grief.
Yeah, it was something else.
Now that you're at the University of California, you must be seeing probably even students from the area that you were in that are now coming to the University of California to learn how they can do more projects themselves.
You mean from North Africa?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, UC gets a lot of foreign students from all over the world. I mean, this is a world-class institution. It's got the top programs in many areas in the whole world.
So when you were back in, again, going back to Northern Africa, when you were back there, were you involved in training people to run these systems?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I was. We brought in 1,000 U.S. Holstein cows, as well as a milking parlor, the equipment, which wasn't something they were used to there. And we were trying to educate them on new feed sources. We were actually experimenting with growing some different feeds. Just the whole thing. Supplies, putting the equipment together, how to handle them. I had to actually design corrals and show them how to work cattle because they weren't used to doing that.
You know, and then you skip all the way ahead. You ended up spending time at the USDA, too, and you were involved with programs all over the United States, involved in North Africa. We even started you off in 4-H, and now you're at the University of California. I'm wondering, all these different experiences, Glenda, what do they have in common? What's the common theme that I think has energized you through your career and the journey you're on right now?
You know, I'm very passionate about agriculture. That really is the commonality. I grew up on a farm. My dad still runs our farm. You know, we human beings need food. Food is, you know, an essential ingredient of life. And yet one of the things I've learned over all the years and in all my different work is that agriculture really needs to be recognized as part of a larger ecosystem. It's not enough just to have the soil and water and seeds in the ground and you grow a crop and you harvest it. You got to think about things like the research of new crop varietals and better ways to store, better refrigeration, the logistics, the distribution, the nutrition. You know, should you be eating this or should you be eating that to stay healthy? All of that and the whole economic aspect of it. As I've gone through my career, I've just learned that I need to understand how that whole ecosystem around agriculture works in order to keep agriculture thriving.
You know, and one of the things when as you're working to keep agriculture thriving, that some critics would feel like we just keep pushing more and more towards industrialization, that's the model of larger and larger scale and more industrialized. But one of the paradox that I see in, you know, what you're involved with the University of California, too, is you're greatly expanding what you're doing with, like, the master gardeners and mm-hmm. with, you know, community gardens and with rooftop gardens. And it's not just a one-way track that just, you know, larger industrialized, but it's also a very micro type of approaches as well.
Yeah, actually, I don't know that we're necessarily seeing a continuous move towards industrialization. In fact, in many ways, there's been quite a backlash against that. We have definitely seen in the last 30 or 40 years bigger and bigger operations and some aspects of operations that do look much more industrial. But we've also seen these really small boutique operations take off too, you know, tied to things like farmers markets and on-farm sales and tying it closer into the restaurants and, you know, a lot of the farm-to-fork type activities people are doing. In some ways, what's been decreasing is that kind of middle-size farm operation. It has a hard time, you know, being profitable.
Mm-hmm.
So some of what we're trying to do, for me at least, as we look at things like systems, how do we make sure that small and medium-scale farms do have access to markets that allow them to thrive? And how do we help the larger farming operations move towards best management practices that are more sustainable?
And how do you do that with, you know, and have it people at all levels within your organization, those that can work at the local level, work with a large scale. So you have extension specialists and researchers and mm-hmm. lots of different departments and what, 9 campuses?
10 campuses.
10 campuses.
But we most of our folks right now are at 3, although we've got folks at a couple more. Plus, we work closely with the CSU system and a lot of external partners, you know, like the commodity groups, in doing all of our work.
Well, you know, Glenda, every time we have a conversation, I'm just am reminded about how fortunate we are to have all of that you're doing at the University of California and how hard it is to keep track of it. I mean, people want to get an idea of the scope of the programs and activities of agriculture and natural resources. Where do you point them? Where do they go for information?
Well, you know, they can go to our website. If you Googled UC Agriculture Natural Resources, we should pop right up. And when you get there, you'll be able to see all the different programs, and you can go look at different programs and see which one interests you. In fact, one thing I really would urge people to look at there, we have a lot of opportunities for volunteers. It's things like being a 4-H leader, being a master gardener, but also our California Naturalist program. We've got several different ways you can volunteer and get active. And we're trying to do more stuff now with citizen science. One of the things I really have made a priority is finding ways via our programs to engage citizens in doing science. A, we just need all of them doing it, but B, it then lets our population become more scientifically literate if they're actually doing it themselves and starting to understand it a little more.
Well, that's exciting because there certainly has been a backlash. A lot of people are just, you know, suspicious of science and, you know, don't understand it. And, you know, and I've known people that would like to figure out how to get involved. So, again, you say they can find that too, find ways that they can volunteer and find these programs on the same website.
Yeah, there's different information on all our programs there. There's a button right on the homepage that will take you to our strategic plan. You can look at that and see what we're planning to do the next several years and see how you might fit in. And you can also go, wherever you live, you can go to your county cooperative extension website. All you need to type in is just the name of your county and the initials, UCCE, University of California Cooperative Extension, UCCE, your county name, and up will pop their website. And that will give you information on specific programs in your county. It'll have a list of all of our specialists and advisors there that you can contact for information. It's pretty good. It's pretty easy to find us and what we do.
You know, Glenda, we have a lot of listeners that aren't in California. They're all over the country. And so if they're outside of California, I assume almost every state has a land-grant university.
Every state has something like we do. Now, every state looks very different.
Sure.
That is one thing I've learned this last couple of years in this job. Every state delivers it just a little bit differently. But every state has a land-grant university. That land-grant university will have something like cooperative extension and its various programs.
And most of those states would have county extension offices as well?
Exactly.
And so they can look up, again, just county extension probably for their local county and find out whatever is available to help them in their county then.
They should be able to, yeah.
Yeah, that sounds good. You know, it's always a pleasure. I tell you what, there is so much going on, and you're in the middle of some exciting projects. I really want to thank you again for taking this time to visit on Farm to Table Talk.
My pleasure, Roger. It's always great to see what you're looking at, too.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.